Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now we're the man's a chance to do things for ourselves. We're tired of beating our head against the wall and working for someone else. Say it loud.
Lehrer on WNYC, and with some appropriate music from 1968, now we continue our series, The Eights, A Brief History of the Culture Wars, Decade by Decade. We will stay in 1968 today as we continue to ask how the heck the United States elected Richard Nixon, of all people, at the end of the 1960s. Today we'll focus on the backlash to the civil rights laws and growing black power movement. 68, of course, was the year that Martin Luther King was assassinated. He had continued to preach love and integration, but as we have discussed on this program a few times this year, he had also become increasingly radicalized and despairing over the persistence of poverty and the Vietnam War. But King was killed in April, and other voices were coming to the fore in the movement for racial equality. One of them was the writer James Baldwin, who appeared on TV in 1968 on The Dick Cavett Show.
I don't know what most white people in this country feel, but I can only include what they feel from the state of their institutions. I don't know if white Christians hate Negroes or not, but I know that we have a Christian church which is white and a Christian church which is black. I know, as Malcolm X once put it, that the most segregated hour in American life is high noon on Sunday. That says a great deal for me about a Christian nation. It means that I can't afford to trust most white Christians and certainly cannot trust the Christian church. I don't know whether the labor unions and their bosses really hate me. That doesn't matter, but I know I'm not in their unions. I don't know if the real estate lobby is anything against black people, but I know the real estate lobbies keep me in the ghetto. I don't know if the Board of Education hates black people, but I know the textbooks they give my children to read and the schools that we have to go to. Now, this is the evidence. You want me to make an act of faith, risking myself, my wife, my woman, my sister, my children, on some idealism which you assure me exists in America, which I have never seen.
So for those of you who never heard his voice before, there was James Baldwin on The Dick Cavett Show in 1968. The Black Panther Party and the phrase Black Power had come into being in 1966. Black Power was coined by Stokely Carmichael, if I have my history right. Black Panther chairman and co-founder Bobby Seale was one of the protest leaders at the 1968 Democratic Convention.
Whenever the people disagree with the political decisions that's been made upon their heads, that whenever the people disagree with those political decisions, the racist power structure sends in guns and force to see that the people accept those political decisions. But we are here as revolutionaries to let them know that we refuse to accept those political decisions that maintain the oppression of our black people and other people in the world.
Bobby Seale, outside the Democratic Convention in Chicago. At the Republican Convention in Miami, Nixon sought to cultivate the white resentment to clips like we just heard in his acceptance speech.
Let those who have the responsibility to enforce our laws and our judges who have the responsibility to interpret them be dedicated to the great principles of civil rights. But let them also recognize that the first civil right of every American is to be free from domestic violence, and that right must be guaranteed in this country.
Nixon from his Republican Convention acceptance speech in August 1968. With me now, Peniel Joseph, University of Texas History and Public Affairs Professor and author of books including Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, A Narrative History of Black Power in America, and Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama. Professor Joseph, always great to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, good to be on with you, Brian.
And we don't often get applause for a telephone guest, but in the green space, sorry, audience, this is what you get, because we really wanted Peniel Joseph on this show, and he lives in Austin, Texas. So can you reflect back to 1968 and how the Martin Luther King movement and the Black Panther or larger Black Power movement either complemented each other or had different goals and worldviews?
Well, I think when we think about Black Power in 1968 and King's movement, when we think about the civil rights movement, they're going to both intersect and diverge with each other. The interesting thing about the Black Power movement is that just like Black Lives Matter in our contemporary context, it's talking about structural and systemic oppression at times in ways that are much more acute and globally focused than the civil rights movement, even though there were civil rights activists, including King, who talked about global systems of oppression. But it's really the Black Power movement that talks about white supremacy as a systemic global superstructure. It talks about capitalism and economic exploitation and racial capitalism. It talks about institutional racism. So Black Power no longer just simply personalizes racism or racial prejudice or racial bias and says these are systemic problems with American democracy and liberal democratic capitalism. And what's interesting about Dr. King is that Dr. King always maintains his commitment to nonviolence and civil disobedience, but he really starts to accept and embrace the Black Power movement's systemic critique of white racism. And certainly that clip that you just played, Brian, James Baldwin becomes the key Black intellectual of the period who is talking and friends with both Black Power activists and civil rights activists. So he's really an extraordinary figure.
Listeners, we invite you to continue with the oral history portion of our series, The Eights, a brief history of the American culture wars, decade by decade. In particular for today, first priority will go to any African-American listeners who remember how your racial consciousness was evolving in 1968. Do we have anybody who fits into that category? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, as we continue to invite different groups of people of different ages with different kinds of memories as we progress through the decades with this series. Were you yourself going from a Martin Luther King mindset to a Black Panther or Black Power mindset or anything else you want to say about your own politics and political self-awareness in 1968 and how you saw white backlash at that time too? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. As, by the way, Dr. Joseph is in a environment with some background music in Austin, Texas, in case you're all wondering where that is. We will live with it. It's not intrusive. It's kind of pleasing. But again, in particular for today, first priority for our oral histories will go to any African-American listeners who remember how your racial consciousness was evolving in 1968. Were you yourself going from a Martin Luther King mindset to a Black Panther or a Black Power mindset or anything else you want to say about your own politics and self-awareness in 68 and how you saw white backlash at that time too, and what did you think when Nixon was elected president? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Professor Joseph, oh, you turned it off, that's good. Or I know you're not home, so you don't have control over that. So why so soon after the major civil rights laws were passed did increasing radicalization take place?
Well, I'd say that the radicalization had been going on all throughout what I call the heroic period of the civil rights movement, which would be May 17th, 1954, and the Brown desegregation Supreme Court decision, all the way to August 6, 1965, and the passage of the Voting Rights Act. So when we look at day to day in every single city in America, there was an increase in protest against racial segregation, against public school segregation, against unions that were disallowing Black people into their unions. So there were building trades protests. So when we look at 1963, for instance, when John F. Kennedy does his major public address to the United States that evening of June 11th, 1963, President Kennedy, before the March on Washington, says that there's a revolution happening in the United States, and it can be a violent or a peaceful revolution. And it's in that speech where he says that, you know, racial equality is part of the American dream. It must be part of American democracy. But he's saying that, Brian, because the summer of 1963, 15,000 people are arrested in civil rights protests all throughout the United States. It's not just Birmingham and Mississippi. It's Philadelphia. It's Oakland. It's New York City. So when we think about what's going on before the passage of the 64 Civil Rights Act and the 65 Voting Rights Act, and before the passage of the Open Housing Act, Fair Housing Act in 68, there's all this social protest and this disruption and this civil disobedience and this organizing for really what we have to think about the civil rights movement as a movement for citizenship. And it's a movement for full and equal citizenship, not just to take away the different institutional forces and state-sanctioned violence that was marginalizing Black citizenship, but to give Black people access to full and unfettered citizenship. By 65, Dr. King, after visiting Watts and cutting short his vacation in Los Angeles, has blown up. He says that citizenship means a living wage, full-time employment, good schools, health care, and good food, and good and safe and secure integrated neighborhoods. So by 1968, Black Power activists are really talking about citizenship, but they're saying that they're making the claim that citizenship is connected to systems of political domination within the United States, but also globally as well.
There was some violence in the protests in 67 in some cities and some in 68 after King was killed. And street crime was rising in those days. How much do you see Nixon as having run on racial backlash in those respects? And how do you see the Democrats as having maybe failed to address it or to compensate politically in some way that contributed to the election of Nixon?
Well, yeah, I think that he absolutely runs on, you know, people call this backlash politics, Brian, but I would really say he's running on an acute and very perceptive understanding of the politics and practices of white supremacy, which always stay consistent and constant in the United States. He's able, much more than George Wallace and much better than Strom Thurmond, who had run in 1948 and 1968 respectively as segregationist, as white supremacist, Nixon is able to congeal that group with a cohesive message of really white nationalism and a cohesive message of law and order, and using racially coded words that people understand are anti-Black. When we think about the Democratic Party, and that's a great question, Brian, in June of 1968, President Johnson signs the Safe Streets Act, and that is an omnibus crime bill in 1968 that provides the context for mass incarceration, and it provides the context for the proliferation of prisons and a prison industrial complex in the United States. And that's really a bipartisan bill, and a Democratic president leads that. So what we see is that at a time in 1968, when the Kerner Commission says that what the country needs is more schools, more jobs, better health care, more social workers, more rehabilitation, more playgrounds, more safety, we get more cops and more brutalization and more violence in Black communities and against Black communities. And that's a bipartisan policy response to not just Black power, but also Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream of a beloved community and a community where poverty and anti-poverty supersedes geopolitical strategies in Vietnam and Southeast Asia and the Cold War. So we get, you know, the communities all across the United States, they ask and plead and demand butter, but they get guns pointed against them.
Let's take a phone call. Here is some oral history from Jan in Brooklyn, who has some memories of 1968. Jan, thank you so much for calling in. You're on WNYC. Can we put up line two there? Jan in Brooklyn. Jan, hi there. Now we've got you.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for calling.
And thank you so much for having this conversation. I was a junior high school student growing up in Texas at the time that Dr. King was killed. And my family were professionals, and we basically supported Dr. King. But when my brother called to tell us that Dr. King had been killed, his And he was a very gentle person, and he was so angry and just made the whole picture of nonviolence. It totally changed for me. Certainly, I guess in the 21st century words, maybe I became radicalized. But, you know, starting wearing my hair natural and making sure that I addressed every instance of disrespect and discrimination that I found in my very segregated community. You know, whether it was the smallest thing of making sure that our voices were heard in the school newspaper or making sure that people had the right to speak out at any kind of gathering. I think that perhaps it was Dr. King's assassination that opened my eyes to the systemic type of racism that certainly I saw every day and I saw growing up in the segregated schools, in transportation, in accommodations. We were, whenever we traveled, especially until we got above past Texas, we certainly had to go on a network of either the fraternities or the sororities or the churches to make sure that we had decent places to stay, decent, safe places to stay. So I was faced with the discrimination every day that you could see as far as living and working was concerned, certainly in Texas at that time.
How much better or not has it gotten, in your opinion, from then to now?
Better? I think that there has been a...
Better or not was my question.
Well, I don't know that we can say totally better. I think there is a face that is different. Certainly, we see more African Americans in places of power. Certainly, at that time, more and more people were running for elective office, and we are standing on the basis of those who were doing that political work at that time. We've had mayors, we've had governors, we've had a black president. The thing is, though, that this conversation is still continuing. A lot of minds and hearts have not been changed. A lot of minds and hearts continue to dwell in a vision of a past America that was better when people had fewer opportunities or options to be able to speak out and to be able to express themselves and to be able to stand and be their total selves without being facing discrimination.
Jan, thank you so much for sharing your memories. And I've got to run, but thank you so much for recalling 1968.
Thank you for listening and for having this conversation.
And please call us again. All right, we're going to take a break, and then we have some more historical clips from 1968, and then we have two special guests with their memories of a particular series of events in 1968 that we will reveal when we come back with them. Brian Lehrer, live from the Green Space on WNYC in our series, The Eights. Brian Lehrer on WNYC in our series, The Eights, a brief history of the culture wars, decade by decade. We're in 1968, and let me play another clip. The student protests were taking place at that time around the country, and certainly here in New York, very famously at Columbia University. And there were really two sets of protests. One was the mostly white student body over the university's relationship with the military during the Vietnam War. The other was by ethnically diverse students and residents of the neighborhood, mostly black, over the location and proposed rules for a new gym that the school was planning to build in Morningside Park. It got the nickname Jim G-Y-M Crow. Here is one anti-gym protester as heard in the documentary Columbia Revolt by Third World Newsreel.
But I don't think a gym 9 stories high with facilities for black people in the basement with a back door is something that black people want. I don't trust anybody in the administrative network of Columbia University because they have lied, they have contradicted themselves. Grayson Kirk wrote us a letter saying, we have stopped the gym. And the next damn day, the Board of Trustees states, we have stopped the gym temporarily.
So that clip from 1968. I'm going to pass along a little 1968 relevant news that just came over. And we report the death of author Tom Wolfe, whose, among other things, book The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test was published in 1968. So Tom Wolfe, and I don't have his age here, but he was quite elderly, and we have just learned. He was just a guest on the show last year, but Tom Wolfe has passed away. With us, two students from Columbia in 1968. Raymond Brown is here in the green space. He grew up to be a prominent attorney who, for example, recently represented Senator Menendez in his corruption trial that ended in a mistrial, and the senator will not be retried. Mr. Brown is a partner at the Greenbaum, Rowe, Smith, and Davis law firm and was a student leader of the Student Afro-American Society at Columbia in 68. And on the phone, Nancy Bieberman, who grew up to be co-founder of the South Bronx Community Group, the Women's Housing and Economic Development Corporation. Raymond and Nancy, thank you for giving us a few minutes. Raymond, where were you in 1968?
1968, I was at the relevant part in Hamilton Hall at Columbia University, part of a distinctly black group of students who held that building as part of a larger demonstration.
And you've written that the New York Times and other media of the day never understood that the black students' occupation of Hamilton Hall was not an ancillary coda to a new left uprising, but the pivotal act of the whole Columbia uprising. Can you explain that and how it was seen by different people at the time?
I think it was deliberately not seen by many. I think the Times inadvertently and deliberately didn't want to deal with the structural question of black students saying, we value our connection to this community. We don't want you to use your institutional power to take land and resources for yourself. And, oh, by the way, we don't like this racist war you're involved in. And that we were pivotally important because on the heels of the uprising in Harlem after Dr. King's death, great sensitivity about moving against us. So our role was pivotal. What's arisen since then has been, I talk to Mark Rudd all the time, and people always ask me, do you know Mark Rudd? And Mark has come up with an answer in which he says, well, do you know the black students of Hamilton Hall? Because we were pivotal, but Chairman Mao, for example, sent us a telegram. He could find out that we were there, but the New York Times couldn't.
Mark Rudd was the white student leader who became iconic as
he
a
did.
Student leader in he 1968. Did. Nancy, you wrote a Times op-ed last year called My Vietnam War, partly about you and the Columbia protest. How did you see the two strands of it then that Raymond was just talking about, and how do you today?
Well, at the time, I was important to note that I was 19 years old, which is to say young. And I arrived at Columbia, nurtured by a family that was liberal. I was always engaged in age-appropriate civil rights activities when I was in high school even. Worked the summer of 64 for the Philadelphia NAACP, where I grew up. And I came to Columbia in 1966 to a campus that was already, activist in the sense that the Vietnam War was a major part of the consciousness of students. Young men were being drafted to go fight in the war, and we were already seeing horrific scenes of slaughter of innocent people on television. You know, Vietnam was famously the first televised war, and, that is how people my age started to understand what was going on in the war and why this war might be different from the war my father fought in World War II.
Let me jump back over to Raymond and ask your reminiscence. That you've written includes how you got support from black leaders of the day like Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown. Where did the gymnasium issue fit into the kinds of things we've been hearing from Peniel Joseph in this segment, and maybe even any larger notions of culture war that tie then to now?
Well, first of all, we for several years had a group that was tried to organize on the basis of race, a great challenge because we were diverse in our backgrounds. James Baldwin was the first person who came to campus. Interestingly enough, you played a clip from James Baldwin earlier. And interestingly enough, he didn't want to talk about himself or his writings, but about who he thought we were and whether our continued identification with the community would override any notions of self-advancement, the upward mobility that's promised in the American dream. At the end, after the demonstration, the first thing we did was to hold a book launch for Harold Cruz's book, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual. The professor you had on earlier has written very much about Cruz's journey from the left to nationalism, but most importantly, the question of whether black folks who have the opportunity to engage in intellectual life have an obligation to the community, and what are the many strands of protest that have run through that. We were self-conscious about that. We had engaged with leadership from across the country, and we had engaged in anti-war activities, as well as engaging with a very indifferent administration, which included Jacques Barzin, who didn't, although he was a great symbol of Western culture, didn't want to talk to us about the deep issues. So we saw ourselves as part of that larger movement. Most of us evolved to some extent as that movement evolved. And the interesting question that's raised about talking about Dr. King is, I think a paramount question was, did we embrace King's philosophical commitment to nonviolence as a means of social reform? Because he was committed as a spiritual matter, both in terms of Christianity and the Gandhiists around him, like Howard Thurman and Benny Mays. Most of us had a much more pragmatic view, and we're prepared to entertain, at least theoretically, other possibilities.
Nancy, do you remember your involvement in the politics of 68 on campus as seeming to you like part of a cultural change that you were trying to bring about in the country or the world?
I think at the time, I think in hindsight, I see it that way. But at the time, we thought we were, that this was very much a political battle that we were fighting, a battle for, stopping what we called and what we believed was an imperialist war, a war that this country chose to fight in to advance a theory that, communism would otherwise take over Southeast Asia, that Vietnam would be among the dominoes to fall, and we would be looking at a communist Southeast Asia, but for American involvement. And we said, no, what are we doing there? We don't belong there. Why are we shedding the blood of innocent civilians and American troops for, this ideology that we disagree with? So I would say that it was a very political decision on our part to oppose the war.
Raymond, in 10 or 15 seconds, do you remember how you felt when Nixon was elected president?
Horrified. All of which was justified. The notion that Ehrlichman later says the war on drugs was designed to marginalize and incarcerate blacks and protesters against the war, it sort of sums up the insidious use of white supremacy to suppress us.
And we're going to go out in this edition of the Eights, Nancy, with a clip of music from the time that you cited in your op-ed by Country Joe. Do you want to tell us why you mentioned it?
1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam.
Well, come on, all of you big, strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. Yeah, he's got himself in a terrible jam. Way down yonder in Vietnam. So put down your books and pick up a gun. Gonna have a whole lot of fun.
And, what Nancy Bieberman wrote in her Times op-ed was the hopeful Dylan, early 60s kinds of songs gave way to this more cynical music by 1968. So we thank Nancy Bieberman and we thank Raymond Brown for joining us on The Brian Lehrer Show.
On Wall Street, don't be slow. Why, man, this war a go-go. There's plenty good money to be made by supplying the army with the tools of his trade. Just hope and pray that if they drop the bomb, drop it on the Viet Cong. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam.